The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. We begin today in South Asia with a 7.5 magnitude earthquake in Afghanistan, felt from Kabul to Islamabad to New Delhi. It's still early, but the death toll is rising in that quake. The epicenter was rural northeastern Afghanistan, about 160 miles from Kabul and not far from the Pakistan border. In Kabul during the quake was Sudarsan Raghavan. He's Afghanistan bureau chief for The Washington Post. Sudarsan, welcome.
Glad to be here, Don.
Can you describe the feeling and the scene when the quake first hit where you are?
There was a vigorous shaking of our house, and it lasted for more than 30 seconds. A lot of our staff just ran outside the house into the yard, really fearful that damage could be done to the building. Certainly our Afghan colleagues, many have been here for years, 30 years or so, were telling me that this is the scariest earthquake they've experienced in their lifetime. So for everyone here in Kabul, despite the fact that we were 160 miles, you know, south of the epicenter, definitely it was quite a scary moment for residents of this city.
What are the reports as of now of damage, especially in the rural areas?
There have been reports coming in from all over Afghanistan, especially the north, of significant damage to houses. There have been reports of landslides. The death toll, as of now, has passed 50 in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the most tragic event so far that we've learned is there are 12 students at a girls' school in Tahar province in northern Afghanistan who died in a frantic dash from shaking buildings. You have to understand that this region, many people, especially in the north, they live in mud houses, which are prone to collapse during an earthquake. It's been raining quite a bit up in the north. We still fully don't know the extent of the damage yet. It's been very difficult to reach people in Badakhshan province where the epicenter was.
Now, this area along the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan is famously an area of Taliban activity, flare-ups. Is there concern that as rescue teams come in to try to clean up the damage, and I realize this quake has just happened, that the conflict aspect of this and the war is going to complicate things terribly?
There is a possibility of that. I mean, Badakhshan province in particular has been a focus of the fighting this year between the Taliban and government forces. So definitely it could pose a significant obstacle for rescue crews going down there, if needed, that is. You also have to understand the germ area is pretty unpopulated, but definitely there certainly could be obstacles posed by the conflict if rescue crews are needed to extricate people or help the wounded.
There is a tragic history, of course, with terrible earthquakes in the region. In 2013, the Quetta earthquake, which killed hundreds of thousands of people in Pakistan. What is the state of disaster response in this area? You said people live in mud houses, and of course, Afghanistan has a lot of other problems now besides earthquake response.
That's correct. I mean, from what I gather, I mean, the emergency efforts here are certainly in Afghanistan have been they're quite limited in terms of resources. I mean, the government has so many other problems to deal with, mainly the security, the insecurity here and fighting against the Taliban and other insurgent forces. Certainly in Pakistan, appear to be much more organized. And you already saw immediately statements from the Pakistani army chief and other officials, you know, saying that they had ordered up the country's forces to start carrying out rescue operations. We've had similar sort of statements here in Afghanistan, but it's only been by a handful of officials. But historically, the Afghans have been somewhat slow to deal with such immense emergency crises. I remember I was here in 2002 when there was another massive earthquake. And at the time, you know, the U.S. military was here and they took the lead basically in helping and assisting the people affected by that tragedy.
A 7.5 magnitude earthquake rocks Afghanistan about 100 miles from Kabul and near the Pakistan border. Sudarsan Raghavan, Afghanistan bureau chief for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for the update.
My pleasure.
It's been been more than a year since the United States launched a coordinated fight against the self-proclaimed Islamic State, and ISIS still controls a great deal of Syria and most of southern Iraq. Now, whatever our next steps, the entire situation is haunted by the long shadow of President Bush's decision to invade Iraq more than 12 years ago. Over the weekend, that point was conceded by former Prime Minister Tony Blair, one of the few world leaders to support the Iraq invasion back in 2003.
You can't say that those of us who removed Saddam in 2003 bear no responsibility for the situation in 2015.
That's Tony Blair speaking with CNN host Fareed Zakaria. Zakaria is the host of a new CNN documentary called Long Road to Hell, America in Iraq. And like Prime Minister Blair, Zakaria offers his own mea culpa right at the end of the film.
I argued that the United States needed to send in many more troops than it did. I urged a UN mandate to provide greater legitimacy and avoid the image of an American occupation. I strongly criticized the decisions to disband the army and dismantle the bureaucracy through debathification. But that does not change the fact that I did support the decision to topple Saddam Hussein's regime.
That mea culpa comes from CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and he joins me now. Fareed, welcome.
Thank you.
Fareed, I had a little bit of trouble with your mea culpa, as much as I appreciate it. You say I wanted more troops. I wanted UN mandate. I basically called for all of the things that they didn't do, all of the things that went wrong. Is there something wrong with the fundamental idea, that we could have toppled a tyrant and a vicious dictator like Saddam Hussein and had it work out? Is that idea wrong?
I think it's a very good question. In the Balkans, the United States was able to intervene, and Bosnia is a functioning state. In Japan and Germany after World War II, we were able to do it. In South Korea, we were able to do it. You know, I don't have a geographic or cultural determinism about it. I don't think that Arabs are genetically incapable of being of self-rule. Looking back at it, I think, you know, my mistake was not to recognize how much work it would take to do this and to have honestly to have trusted that the Bush administration would do it right. But you do ask the legitimate question, which is, was the whole society so fragile that once you took the top off, would the whole thing have crumbled? Well, it didn't in Bosnia, it didn't in South Korea, it didn't in Germany, it didn't in Japan. But perhaps the modern Middle East is so artificial, created by the British and French after World War I, that really you mess with these nations at your peril because they're not really nations at all.
Well, let's talk about the present and the future then, Fareed, because the tragedy of what that suggests, what you're suggesting right now, which is the possibility that lifting off the top of the British and French constructed Iraq would automatically lead to what we're seeing today, suggests that there's a determinism to this, that ISIS and the sectarian war going on across Iraq and Syria sort of has to happen, that Sunnis and Shia, that Assad and the Kurds, for that matter, have to sort it out. And that's an argument against American intervention, just kind of letting them fight it out and seeing where the dust settles.
I have been very cautious about any greater American role. I, in fact, feel like President Obama is inching forward too much. He's been very restrained. And here's why. It's not just the lesson of Iraq. If you look at, we intervened in Iraq, we had 170,000 troops at the peak, and we were not able to prevent a civil war, chaos, and a humanitarian catastrophe. We intervened in Libya, we toppled the regime, but we didn't put troops down to avoid the taint of an occupation. It has produced chaos and a humanitarian catastrophe. In Yemen, we merely acceded to a regime change, and what you have is civil war and chaos. And in Syria, we haven't intervened at all, and what you have is civil war and chaos. So it makes me feel that these places are very fragile and that outside forces have only so much ability to really go in. If we send in 500,000 troops and occupied the place like Germany for, you know, close to a decade, would it be different? Who knows? But short of something like that, it seems as though we should be very careful. And you are exactly right. What I think is going to happen is there is going to be a great sectarian sorting out in the Middle East, that these populations were intermingled, and they are much less so now than they were 10 years ago. But what you're seeing is a process of forced and voluntary ethnic cleansing. where the Alawites are moving into areas, the Shiites are moving into areas, the Kurds are moving. And when that happens, there will probably be some kind of war weariness and stability that will set in. I think we should be engaged diplomatically, we should be engaged politically, and we should do as much as we can from a humanitarian point of view. But I do not believe that the United States can intervene militarily in a way that would be effective.
Well, Fareed Zakaria, let's look to 2017. There's a Republican field now that says pour troops in. Lindsey Graham and the other candidates are certainly in that camp. Donald Trump says fight them, fight them, fight them. I'm not even sure he knows what that means. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee, is hawkish herself and has a long track record of favoring intervention. Where do you see this realistically going?
The Republican side has been very interesting. The most interventionist candidate, Lindsey Graham, has gone nowhere. You have a few of them talking about it really as a way to criticize President Obama, but without much of an alternative. And Trump is, in a very Trumpian fashion, all over the place. One day he says, look, I think Assad is better than ISIS. Why aren't we supporting Assad? Another day he says, look, they're all fighting over there. Let them fight it out. And then on a third day he says, oh, I would defeat ISIS. So you have no idea what exactly he means. And I think Trump knows in a way that most people have mixed views on this. Trump is, I've always thought, a great businessman in that he just gives people what they want. And he knows that on Syria they have these shifting or conflicting views, and so he just airs all of them. Hillary is the most interesting one. You are exactly right. She is more interventionist, or her inclinations are more interventionist than Obama's. She apparently was in favor 2 years ago of helping the Free Syrian Army. I don't know what she would make of the fact that it turned out that there was no Free Syrian Army and the few they could find disappeared or evaporated. But I think were she to be president, you're probably likely to see more incremental interventions, more of the no-fly zones, the training of troops. And as I say, my own prediction is they will fail. So then the question becomes, are you able to hold the line? Are you able to say, look, we tried, we did the best we could, but we're not going to go any further?
Fareed Zakaria and his new documentary on CNN, Long Road to Hell, America in Iraq. Fareed, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Later on this hour, explicit lyrics. Did your parents disapprove of the music that you listened to? We're talking about the history of parental advisory stickers later this hour. What made it so controversial? Has your music lost any of its shock value today? From Vermont, my dad let me buy the Beastie Boys' License to Ill when I was 5. I don't know what he was thinking, but I'm thankful that he's always fought for my right to party. From Long Island, my poor parents had to suffer through me listening to and singing along with NWA.
This is Lorinda from Oak Park, Michigan. When I was young, my parents were young as well, and we often listened to the same music. But in seventh grade, that all changed. Kiss Alive came out, and I was obsessed. They were not happy.
Get up! Get your grandma out of here! Give us your take, 8778-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, hosting a live online discussion on healthy eating habits for kids with the CEO of Probo Health. Tomorrow night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Every time you step into an Uber or a Lyft or you call someone from TaskRabbit, you're dealing with a worker participating in what's now called the gig economy. And more of these workers are kind of independent contractors picking up steady work, but also operating without health care or pensions or overtime, the things that traditional employees get. Now, these folks, for the most part, report their income on federal 1099 forms, not W-2s. And before you glaze over at the sound of tax forms, for these folks, there is a world of difference between a 1099 and a W-2. The big difference? 1099 save companies tens of thousands of dollars per worker in Social Security and Medicare deductions, as well as workers' comp and other expenses. Of course, the Ubers and Lyfts and the other gig employers out there argue that this growing employment model creates jobs and is a great fit for a flexible workforce. But it also shows how our labor law, from your tax status on down, appears to be lumbering behind modern employment practices that could be edging workers out of benefits they've enjoyed for decades. Jeff Berkovici is San Francisco bureau chief for Inc. magazine, and he calls it the 1099 bind.
For the last 20 years, we've been seeing a shift in the way Americans work, away from traditional full-time labor arrangements and toward lighter weight arrangements, more flexible contingent work, as it's often called by economists. A lot of that just has to do with the disappearance of the sort of traditional, you know, 40-hour a week jobs, manufacturing jobs, and other 9-to-5 union-based jobs that we think of as having driven so much of the economy in the last half of the 20th century.
The law right now says there's a minimum wage, there's a 40-hour work week, there are workplace safety regulations. There is a big movement in this country saying a worker who wants to work for $5 an hour or wants to work just for surge pricing with no benefits, they have a right to do it if they want.
Exactly. And these companies even, in many cases, they're taking it a step further by saying, we are not even an employer in the first place. We are just a marketplace. We are a place where somebody who needs a ride and somebody who has an extra space in his car can meet up and shake hands and do business. And all Uber does is make the introduction and take a cut of the fare. The counter argument to that is that's just obviously not really true.
All right. So look, Uber's the popular example, and we all know about it, but the vast majority of us aren't Uber drivers, probably never will be, or may never work for Lyft or TaskRabbit. What does this mean for the rest of the economy? And what does this mean for the, you know, 150 or 200 million people who still have regular traditional jobs with W-2s?
So much of this is taking place in the context of the widening inequality gap that we all talk about. What they're doing really, on the one hand, is connecting an increasingly wealthy consumer base that can afford to do things like pay people to do their laundry and deliver food to them every night with an increasingly large base of people who no longer have secure employment, and it's worth it to them to make a couple bucks an hour to run someone else's errands for them.
So what does that mean for this race to the bottom then? What do we need to do as the economy changes and consumption drives the economy? What do we need to do with the 1099s, with the W-2s, or the laws that undergird them to avoid a complete race to the bottom here?
For a lot of these companies, the only way that they're even approaching making a profit is essentially by capitalizing on that margin in between what they really should be paying for their workforce and what they are paying for that workforce, because right now they're sort of flying under the regulatory radar. Companies with a real stable business model also happen to be companies that will be able to afford to ultimately pay the worker protections that they need to be paying.
Does there need to be something else? Does there need to be a hybrid? Something that's not a W-2 or a 1099, or do we need a movement that pushes these casual people onto the more traditional forms of employment so that they're safe on W-2 island and not vulnerable?
Germany and Canada both are among the countries that do have a dependent contractor category, but those also happen to be countries that have a very strong social safety net. We don't have that, and just creating that labor class, you know, in some ways it's just going to make the regulatory tangle that we already have that much harder to sort out.
Jeff Berkovici, San Francisco bureau chief for Inc. magazine. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your take on the gig economy? Do you crave the flexibility offered by these startups? Or do you think workers are getting taken advantage of? You can give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE to tell us your story. Jeff's article about the end of Uber-like companies is in the November issue of Inc. magazine, and we have a lot more over at thetakeaway.org. Louis C.K. is a dad, of course, in addition to being a comedian and actor. And he became a favorite of education activists last year when he spoke out about standardized testing on David Letterman. Listen.
They prepped to prepare for these tests for a long time. A lot of the year is about the tests.
Teaching for the test.
Teaching to the test, they call it, because they decided there's a new way kids should think, and we're going to prove they're thinking it by having them pass these tests, or we burn the school down. So...
Well, it seems that the White House, for one, was listening. Over the weekend, President Obama announced new recommendations aimed at reducing the amount of time that schools and kids spend on standardized testing.
Learning is about so much more than just filling in the right bubble. So we're going to work with states, school districts, teachers, and parents to make sure that we're not obsessing about testing.
Back in 2010, the Common Core Initiative created national standards for each grade throughout the country. Some touted the new reforms as forward-thinking and a step toward leveling the playing field in student achievement. But it's also drawn a lot of controversy and criticism from educators, teachers, parents, policymakers, who all say teachers now spend too much time teaching to the test. Beth Berkley teaches 7th grade language arts at James Martin Middle School in Charlotte, North Carolina. Beth, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Would you describe your typical day or maybe your typical week when it's testing time in the 7th grade there at James Martin Middle School?
Absolutely. So the state of North Carolina requires that each student take a test in each subject at the end of the year. It's called our end of grade testing in middle school. In high school, it's called the end of course test. So students have to take in middle school math, language arts, science, and social studies tests. For the math and language arts, we start testing at about 9:30, and we don't finish until about 2:30. So the students spend an absurd amount of time testing in the spring in math and language arts.
And how much time do you spend preparing them for that test?
We spend the entire year preparing them. So much of what we're required to do now is not only just to teach the content, but to teach them how to take a test. During that time, we really fail to prepare them for the biggest test of all, which is life. Instead, we're teaching them how to fill in, you know, Scantron sheet and how to eliminate answer choices, and not actually preparing them to be successful, you know, to go on to the workforce or to go on to college.
So does that mean that 7th grade language arts, which I guess we used to call English, I suppose,
yes,
is more like an LSAT or SAT prep course now than, you know, reading Huckleberry Finn or maybe getting your first taste of Shakespeare?
It depends on the classroom you go into. Because I do work at a Title I school, it is lower performing school according to our testing data. So we are forced to spend a lot of our time and resources finding ways to raise our test scores. So when I first started teaching here about 3.5 years ago, we did do a lot of novels, and we did do a lot of, reading and literature circles and reading things that the kids really enjoyed. And now, because our test scores have not shown a significant improvement, we're forced to kind of change the way we teach, and students spend time using a lot of computer programs that are aligned more to the test, rather than doing things in the classroom that they enjoy.
And what's your life like as a teacher? I mean, do you have the principal or the superintendent or the local testing czar, whoever that is, looking over your shoulder and saying, Berkey, you got to get those scores up, close up Huck Finn and get those scores up?
Thankfully, I've seen pretty good results on the tests, so I haven't had an experience like that. But I will say in our whole staff meetings, it is pushed very hard. You know, they pull up the data on the board and we review it, and everything that we do is data driven. So even if it's not a standardized test, we are required to give interim assessments as well. And all of this data has to be scanned, and we have to review it with our administrators to figure out how we are going to push these kids that aren't performing on the state tests to pass.
Now, we should add, I mean, the White House has said this, they've made recommendations, but at this point, the president's recommendations don't have a great deal of say-so over what a local school district or even a state does. Beth Berkey, you're kind of an experiment of one, because you've taught at schools that don't have this kind of rigorous testing and don't really focus on it. So how has your life changed as a teacher going from that environment to the one that you're in now?
That's true. Yeah, when I taught in Pennsylvania, I taught 9th grade, and they did not test at the time in 9th grade. And I do believe they are testing in every grade now, but I didn't give a single test or quiz all year during that time. And when I came down to North Carolina, I remember sitting in one of my first meetings working with all the 7th grade language arts teachers and working with our facilitators. And we were going over how to plan for the year and scheduling out all of our tests and scheduling all of our quizzes. And I remember actually saying out loud, well, when do we get to teach things that actually matter?
So what would you want to do with the extra time now? I mean, I envision you taking the White House's statement in your fist and marching down to the principal's office, you know, to get these changes made. What would you do with the extra time if these tests went away?
I like to spend a lot of time talking with students about real world issues. So one of my favorite units that we actually do is on diversity and stereotypes. And I really want my students to feel empowered and to feel like they can make a difference in this world. So I try to still do that as much as I can, you know, by choosing articles and short stories and with the freedom that I do have, choosing texts that do teach actual lessons that they can use in life. But definitely incorporating more of that into the classroom would be my first step.
Is there anything that's fallen by the wayside because you just don't have time because of the test? Is there a book or a unit that you'd love to do that you just haven't had time to do?
I feel like I haven't had time to do anything, honestly. You know, the statement that President Obama made was concerning standardized testing. But I think what we fail to realize is we spend so much time testing in general. It's not just, you know, the end of grade tests that students have to take. We have to give weekly quizzes. We have to give 6-week assessments. We have to give 9-week assessments. We have tests that students take 3 times throughout the year to measure their growth in reading and math. So it's not just the standardized test that's the issue. It's testing as a whole. That's become our sole means of measuring our students' growth is multiple choice tests.
Moves from the White House over the weekend to suggest a reduction in standardized testing in American schools. Beth Berkey teaches 7th grade language arts at James Martin Middle School in Charlotte, North Carolina. Beth Berkey, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, hosting a live online discussion on healthy eating habits for kids with the CEO of Curbo Health. Tomorrow night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
We're going to wrap up this hour with a warning, a parental warning, really, about explicit lyrics, the kind that could have gotten you in big trouble as a kid. Bastard by Motley Crue. And here's Cyndi Lauper with the suggestive and subversive Shebop. As we're going to hear in a minute, both of those songs landed their artists on a list, a real list of explicit and dangerous lyrics compiled by some very powerful people back in the 1980s. And kids all over America learned that just because your favorite band got to say bad stuff doesn't mean it was okay for you.
Hi, I'm Selke Hope from Charleston, South Carolina. When I was 13, I asked my mother for Red Hot Chili Peppers' Californication.
Destruction leads to a very rough road, but it also breeds creation. An earthquake's out to a girl's guitar, that's just another good vibration. And tidal waves couldn't save the world from Californication.
I immediately had my mouth washed out with soap and was banned from listening to the radio for months. It took me about 5 years to figure out why.
I love to love you, baby.
My name is Ramona. I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas. When I was in the 6th grade, we would have record week. One of my classmates brought the Donna Summer song, Love to Love You, Baby. The music teacher absolutely refused to play it because of all the passionate moans and groans in the song.
Our struggle over taste and decency is a lot older than the First Amendment itself. But that little black and white warning label in the corner of albums, the one that says parental advisory explicit content, has a much more recent history. The label dates back to a movement in the 1980s started by the wives of two politicians, Tipper Gore and Susan Baker. 25 years later, the labels had become so commonplace that we don't even notice them anymore. But they're there on albums ranging from Justin Bieber to Nicki Minaj to pretty much anything that sells. Now, this is all detailed in a new retro report out today called Sex, Drugs, and Gore, With me now is the producer of that report, Joshua Fisher. Josh, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So bring us back to the late 1980s, to the PMRC, the Parents Music Resource Center, Senate hearings, Tipper Gore, and Susan Baker. What was it like?
Well, it was reportedly it was the biggest media event in congressional history. That's what they say. I don't know if we can actually prove that, but there certainly were a lot of cameras there that day, September day in 1985. On one side, you had Tipper Gore and Susan Baker, the Washington Wives, the PMRC. On the other side, you had musicians like Frank Zappa, John Denver, and Dee Snider of Twisted Sister.
Saying that even voluntary labeling of lyrics amounted to censorship, and also don't blame us for society's problems, essentially.
Right. That was really the kind of the subtext of what was going on. They're debating over labeling and censorship, but the claim was that these rock lyrics, which were sexual, violent, were having a dangerous impact, were harming kids. And they said, you know, contributed everything from suicide to teenage pregnancy to other kind of social problems.
Well, let's take a listen to a clip from your film where Susan Baker, who is the wife of then Treasury Secretary James Baker, and Tipper Gore are talking about their own experiences with their own kids.
Our daughter was only 7. And she came to me one day and she said, "Mom, what's a virgin?"
Like a virgin, touched for the very first time.
And she said, "What does that mean?" I said, "Oh my gosh." Then Tipper, her daughter, bought Purple Rain, Princess Purple Rain. I met a girl named Nikki. Guess you could say she was a sex fiend.
I met her in a hotel lobby, masturbating with a magazine.
I did not feel that was appropriate for my then 10-year-old child to have purchased.
But it just made us angry. And we knew that others didn't know about it, so we just thought, you know, we have to do something.
It seems like there was a bit of an attack of convenience here. Complex social problems that were hard to solve, violent crime and teen pregnancy, both of which were high at the time, and that politicians and or their wives sort of turned to a convenient target, the music industry.
Exactly. And that's really the key. Popular culture in whatever form, music, comic books previously, it's an easy target. You can go after it and say, well, look, we've got these songs out there that are talking about sex or they're really violent. You've got album covers that are just shocking to look at. And clearly this must be having an impact on children. And so, you know, it's also a way to kind of connect with people across the country and kind of make the case that something's wrong and something needs to be done.
And indeed, I don't know if you and your friends were like me and my friends, but we went for the records that had the label. Did these artists wind up making a great deal of money thanks to Tipper Gore?
Well, a lot of them claim that it boosted record sales. I did look into that, and I was not able to find any definitive proof that an album that has the black and white parental advisory sticking on it does better than it would have had not, or that record sales went up, you know, post-labeling. But one thing that does happen is that nowadays there's often the explicit version and the clean version. So you've got kind of two products that you can sell, and that probably does help, you know, boost sales to some degree.
Yeah, because everyone knows which is the better version.
Exactly.
So what's the lesson then for history here? The labels still exist. They're so much a part of music culture now that they're almost ignored. Nobody really seems all that shocked anymore that Nicki Minaj has lyrics and imagery filled with sex. Have we become completely inured to this, or have we learned that art is art and social problems are social problems and that censorship doesn't necessarily solve any of the things that we want to solve?
Well, I think what happens is the debate goes on, but the medium, if you will, changes. The form that it takes changes over time. So if you go back in history, you can see there was the same exact debate happened in the 1950s over comic books, a big furor over comic books harming children. In the 80s, it was music. Later on, it might be video games or whatever's next, whatever the new thing that adults fear that kids are into and that they don't really get. That's where you're going to find the friction, the tension, the genesis of a new controversy.
Censorship, the battle over rock and roll, and just how much damage it was doing to the kids. Not a new debate. Joshua Fisher is producer of the Retro Report, and it's all in the new Retro Report documentary out today, Sex, Drugs, and gore. Joshua Fisher, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Christine from Fort Washington. I'll never forget listening to Billy Joel when we were on vacation in Wildwood, New Jersey, and he was singing Your Sister's Out on a Date. She's on a date. And you just sit at home. And you sit home and masturbate. And my mom said, "What? What did he just say?" I was 13 and could not stop laughing. Other than that one isolated instance, I have to say my parents were always very chill with whatever we played.
And you can reach us too at 8778-MYTAKE. You can also see Retro Report's full documentary at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening today. This is The Takeaway with no parental advisory whatsoever. I'm Todd Zwillick. Just a little.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.